obviously, as Marxists, as revolutionaries, it's extremely important that we understand what the state is, what it is that we're fighting against, and what it is that we hope to establish, to achieve in the socialist revolution. And when you look at the bourgeois philosophy, bourgeois history, it's almost impossible to get an understanding of what the state is and how it arises and its role in society. And this can be very clear, for example, when you look at something like the English Revolution, for example. Very, very complicated, and it seems to deal more with religion and other issues rather than class issues. But when you look at it from a Marxist point of view, you can actually bring out the class content of a historical event such as the English Revolution. And we can understand that the English Revolution was a bourgeois revolution, which was expressed in the language of religion. And so Marxism as a tool allows us to gain a proper understanding of history and put things in their proper place. So basically, Marxism understands the state as a tool of class oppression. It's a tool, an apparatus developed by one class for the oppression or subjugation of other classes in society. Essentially, it's for a minority class to enable it to rule over the majority of society. It's very, very important that we understand the state for other reasons, of course, from contemporary reasons as well. If you look at the Venezuelan Revolution, if we didn't have an understanding of the state, we would be in a mess in relation to the Venezuelan Revolution, as most of the other groups on the left are, denouncing Chavez as a Bonaparte or as a bourgeois or whatever. And of course, our understanding of the state allows us to see that, Venezuela still is a bourgeois state, Chavez is the president of a bourgeois country, but that the actual ruling class has temporarily lost control of its own state. And this is what has allowed us to come up with our position and our attitude towards Chavez and the Bolivarian Revolution. And so essentially, yes, the state is an apparatus of class oppression. And Engels even went so far as to define the state as special bodies of armed men. And this is very, very clearly seen when the class struggle erupts into the open, such as the British miners' strike. Suddenly, the role of the state, the class nature of the state, becomes very, very clear. In the miners' strike in Britain, basically what you have is the organizations of the working class, the trade unions, in direct conflict with the state. And it's all aspects of the state. In the miners' strike, you saw everything. You saw the courts and the judicial system and the police and possibly even the military involved in this conflict defending the interests of the bourgeoisie. And it's important that we understand that the state doesn't actually create these divisions in society, these class divisions in society. It's the actual class divisions themselves which give rise to the state. Now the state can re-strengthen or sort of reinforce these divisions and create them on other levels, but it doesn't itself create them, it comes from them. And of course, there was a time, the majority of human history, there was no state. The state did not exist. Classes did not exist. There was no section of society which needed to be subjugated, which needed to be oppressed by a state. There was no class which needed the state to oppress the rest of society. And so this sort of period of history we refer to, or Engels refers to, as primitive communism. Of course, it wasn't sort of lawless anarchy or anything like that. There was a general social order. People were more or less equal, and people were governed by tradition and things like that. And there were leaders, of course, as well. There were the elders of the tribes and all these different kinds of things. But as such, there was no state. There was no special armed bodies of men. There were no prisons. There was no judicial system. There were no constitutions or anything like that. Just direct human relations. But of course, this all begins to change when you basically have the agricultural revolution, when people stop nomadic movements, to stop basically hunting and gathering, and they settle down into permanent settlements and the development of agriculture. Now this development of agriculture allows for the first time a surplus of products, a surplus of food and goods beyond what is required for the day-to-day survival of the people. And so for the first time, there's a section of society which is now freed from the productive process, freed from the daily struggle for survival. And they are now free to rule, to devote themselves to ruling and to absorbing the surplus which is created. And this is the first division of society into classes. And essentially out of this you get the development of slave-owning society. So the slave owners obviously need to develop an apparatus in order to defend their property and their interests, which includes, at this point in history, human beings. And out of this now, you see that people, rather than devoting themselves to production and to work, they're now devoting themselves to other cultural, artistic pursuits. And you see the flowering of human culture and development in Greece and Rome, basically. First sort of Western civilizations, the first development of civilization, so to speak. And it's also important to realize that the state doesn't exist as easily definable categories all the time. You have slave-owning states, but of course they have different forms. In Greece, you have the democratic city-states. In Rome, you can see the development from a monarchy to a democratic republic, and of course to the Roman Empire, the dictatorship of the land-owning estates, and so on and so forth. But none of this changes the fact that these states, no matter what form it was still the state of the slave owners. A democratic slave-owning state means democracy only for the slave owners, not for the slaves themselves. And you can see this process sort of repeating itself throughout history, under whether it's feudalism, capitalism, or even socialism. You can see that the state can take many, many different forms, but it's important to understand that at root it is still a state, it's still a tool of class oppression. And of course, the high point of slave society was of course, depending on how you want to look at it, basically the Roman Empire, which developed slave society to the greatest extent possible, basically. The Roman Empire could do no more than what it actually did. And out of the long and protracted collapse of the Roman Empire, you get the development of feudalism, of the landed nobility, the landed aristocrats, and so on and so forth. And this basically, out of the Dark Ages, you get a group of counts and barons and nobles, whatever you want to call them, who establish their rule in a defined territory. And they have to develop the tools necessary to keep the serfs on their lands down and to protect their land from other opposing nobles and barons who might attack them. And the fundamental division of society has now changed. Society is not divided between the slave owners and slaves, it's divided now between the nobility and the serfs. And this is it's important to realize that there is a very profound difference in relations between people. Now maybe for the serfs, for the peasants, there is no real difference. They're still oppressed severely by the landlord, but they're no longer slaves, they're no longer considered the property of the landlord. So the serf was tied to his land. He generally had to work a proportion of his week, maybe 3 or 4 days or whatever it is, for the landlord, producing food and wealth for the landlord. But the rest of the week he has for himself to develop his own wealth in whichever way he can. Now this is important because this small amount of freedom, this little extra bit of freedom that the peasant has, actually in the end gives rise to the development of the bourgeoisie, to the capitalist class. But in the meantime, it's important to realize that what you have is in the feudal state or the slave-owning state, whatever state, is the nobles as a whole come together and build an apparatus which defends them as a whole. So rather than the noble or the aristocrat, whatever, being isolated on his land, having to defend himself on his own, he now has a state apparatus which defends him and his other class, brothers and sisters, so to speak, as a whole. It defends them as one and allows them to operate as a class. And so basically what you have under feudalism is the development, a process of concentration of wealth, a process of urbanization, and the development of the middleman, of the merchant, who develops trade, he develops industry, he develops commerce, and so on and so forth. But the development of world trade, the discovery of the Americas, the development of world trade, the development of the world market, it's this class, the bourgeois class, which now rises to prominence. Within the heart of feudal society, and the feudal landlords, the aristocrats, their economic power actually begins to decline. And what you see is the development of capitalism, the development of factories, the development of industries, the development of cities and trade, has now actually come up and smacked itself against the confines of feudalism, the small parochial narrow limits of feudalism. So basically what you have under feudalism is small plots of land, or regions where they have their own measurements, their own money, their own taxes, and all these kinds of things. And there's the funny story that Alan quotes from a German merchant in his document on the national question, where a German merchant decides he wants to go from northern Germany to southern Germany to sell his products, and he has to pass through something like 300 different principalities, he has to pay different tax rates, there's different monetary systems, there's a whole bunch of different parasitic, basically, policies, which prevent him from freely selling his goods. And you can see that feudalism was a complete impediment to the future development of man, to the development of the productive forces, and the development of the economy. And what you have in the 18th and the 19th centuries is the complete destruction of feudal society. It's the age of bourgeois revolutions, basically, from the English Revolution up until basically the founding of the German state in the 1870s, is the age of the rise of the bourgeois. And everywhere in Europe, in the what we now call the advanced capitalist countries, feudalism is torn asunder. And all these local restrictions and parochialisms are completely broken down, and society is reestablished now on a much larger basis, on a national level. You have the development of countries, nation states, nationalism, and so on and so forth. And the bourgeoisie rebuilds society in its interests and in its image, essentially. And you have the productive forces have now been liberated and able to move forward on a much higher basis than what they were before. Now, the bourgeois state was an enormously progressive development upon feudal or slave-owning states. Basically, now the in the eyes of the law, in the eyes of the people, everybody is supposed to be equal, or at least in terms of sort of bourgeois philosophy, bourgeois revolution. Everybody is equal before the law. And what you can see is that bourgeois democracy was actually the revolutionary tool that the bourgeois was able to use to battle feudalism. And it allowed them to build revolutionary movements and to attack feudalism as a class, again, as a whole. And these institutions which they built in the revolutionary struggle, they then turned them into the state apparatus for their rule over society. And what you can see, actually, is that the bourgeois state is the perfection, almost, of the state as an apparatus of oppression. You can see throughout history that each successive revolution modifies the state, perfects the state to do its job better, to oppress in a much better way. And with the development of bourgeois democracy, this oppression is almost, it's not quite as visible, for example, under slave-owning society or feudal society, when the oppression of the peasants or the slaves is brute force, basically, absolute brute force. Now, democracy means that you're actually involved in your own oppression, and you get to vote for the guy who is going to go in parliament and oppress you, and it makes you feel much more involved and much better about the situation. But the bourgeois themselves have no real attachment to bourgeois democracy. Democracy initially, particularly if you look at the French Revolution or the revolutions in the 19th century, democracy was for the property-owning class. It was for the bourgeois, so that they could decide amongst themselves in a relatively peaceful way how to go about implementing their policies or building the nation in their interests. And the democratic rights, which we now all enjoy, universal suffrage and all these kinds of things, were actually conquered by the working class in struggle against the bourgeoisie. And the bourgeoisie, sort of in the initial stages, reluctantly gave these rights away in to prevent revolution, essentially. And if you look at the advanced capitalist countries in the West, in Europe and North America, you can see the bourgeois democracy is actually the favorite method of control of the bourgeois. It's the cheapest, most efficient way for them to go about ruling society and oppressing everybody else. But basically, again, under capitalism, and I don't want to get into a long discussion about the different forms of the state under capitalism, but you can see that, again, as in with every other state, there's many, many different forms of bourgeois states. You have bourgeois democracy, you have military dictatorships, you have fascism, you have all these different kinds of wonderful forms. And generally what you can see is in countries where class relations are not quite as defined, and where the rule of the bourgeoisie is much, much weaker, that's where you can see that democracy flies out the window and the bourgeoisie installs itself quite violently at the head of society. And the bourgeois have no great love for democracy. If their system is threatened, they won't hesitate for a second to get rid of democracy and rule directly by naked force. And you can see this throughout the history of the last 200 years, particularly in between the wars, with the development of fascism in Germany and Italy and so on and so forth. You can see that as a last resort, the bourgeoisie will not hesitate to get rid of democracy to ensure their rule. Now, the development of capitalism and the bourgeois state is also important in terms of the development of the proletariat. While capitalism as a system actually breaks down the peasantry and actually breaks down the petty bourgeois, the shopkeepers, and attacks their class at a very basic level, it actually serves to unite and concentrate the proletariat in production, to large concentrations in factories, in cities. And in this process, it serves to make the proletariat conscious of itself as a class and develops the class struggle. So that's why, as Marxists, we will always fight for any democratic right, no matter how minor or important. We will always fight for that right because it is very, very important in terms of the class struggle. And there's actually a quote here. on Lenin, which I was going to read, which sort of explains that in a rather concise way. So Lenin says, the democratic republic and universal suffrage were an immensely progressive advance compared to feudalism. They have enabled the proletariat to achieve its present unity and solidarity, to form those firm and disciplined ranks which are waging a systematic struggle against capital. There was nothing even approximately resembling this amongst the peasant serfs, not to speak of the slaves. The slaves would be no revolted, rioted, started civil wars, but they could never create a class-conscious majority and parties to lead the struggle. They could not clearly realize what aims they were moving towards, and even in the most revolutionary moments of history, they were always pawns in the hands of the ruling class. Later on, he says, mankind moved towards capitalism, and it was capitalism alone which, thanks to urban culture, enabled the oppressed proletarian class to become conscious of itself and to create the world working class movement. The millions of workers organized all over the world in parties, the socialist parties which are consciously leading the struggle of the masses. Without parliamentarism, without an electoral system, this development of the working class would have been impossible. So you can see that actually in developing democracy, which is the most efficient way for the bourgeois to rule, they're actually also developing their grave digger, as Marx said, the proletarian. Now, then when we come to the question of the development of worker space, of the socialist revolution, it gets a little bit complicated, and inevitably we're going to run into the question of Stalinism, and I don't want to spend the whole time talking about Stalinism. We can probably come to that in the discussion. But on a theoretical level, you can see that the socialist revolution, the worker state, marks a radical change in the development of the state, in the history of the state. Because for the first time, rather than the state being the apparatus or the tool of oppression of one class over another, a minority over the majority, for the first time the state is now a tool of oppression in the hands of the majority against the minority. And there's actually another quote here which shows it quite the class nature of the state. It comes from Engels, where he says, every revolution, by destroying the state apparatus, shows us the naked class struggle. It shows us how the ruling class strives to restore special bodies of armed men which serve it, and how the oppressed class strives to create new organizations of this kind, capable of serving the exploited instead of the exploiters. And so essentially what you have is the state is the ruling class is organized as the ruling class. So a worker state is the proletariat organized as the ruling class. Now what are the tasks of the proletariat in organizing itself as the state? Its task is to dissolve class divisions. Its task is to dissolve the minority into the minority. And if those class divisions are then eradicated, then there is essentially no material basis for the existence of a state. Sorry, I'm quoting a lot, but these people say things much better than I can. There's a rather lengthy quote here from Engels, which basically describes the tasks of the proletarian state and the future of a proletarian state. Because the proletariat seizes the state power and turns the means of production into state property to begin with, but thereby it abolishes itself as the proletariat, abolishes all class distinctions and class antagonisms, and abolishes also the state as a state. Society thus far, operating amid class antagonisms, needed the state, that is, an organization of the particular exploiting class, for the maintenance of its external conditions of production, and therefore, especially, for the purpose of forcibly keeping the exploited class in the conditions of oppression determined by the given mode of production, slavery, serfdom, wage labor, etc. The state was the official representative of society as a whole, its concentration in a visible corporation. But it was this only insofar as it was the state of that class which itself represented, for its own time. Society as a whole, in ancient times, the state of slave-owning citizens, in the Middle Ages of the feudal nobility, in our own time of the bourgeoisie. When at last it becomes the real representative of the whole of society, it renders itself unnecessary. As soon as there is no longer any social class to be held in subjugation, as soon as class rule and the individual struggle for existence based upon the present anarchy in production, with the collisions and excesses arising from the struggle, are removed, nothing more remains to be held in subjection. Nothing necessitating a special coercive force, a state. The first act by which the state really comes forward as the representative of the whole of society, the taking possession of the means of production in the name of society, is also its last independent act as a state. State interference in social relations becomes, in one domain after another, superfluous and then dies down of itself. The government of persons is replaced by the administration of things and the conduct of processes of production. The state is not abolished, it withers away. This gives the measure of the value of the phrase of, whatever, that's not important. So here you can see what the development of the proletarian state is, what the goal of socialism actually is. The worker state is still a tool of class oppression. Now it's the working class, the majority of society, oppressing the minorities, the old owners, the bosses, the capitalists, in order to dissolve those class divisions and actually create a society where there is no state necessary. So that's the basic sort of general theoretical look of what a worker state should be and how it should develop and what the end result is. Now obviously when you look at the actual development of history, this isn't what happened. If you look at the Soviet Union, the worker state did not wither away, it did not disappear, and in fact it grew enormously. And in fact you saw, particularly in the 1930s and the 1940s, the development of one of the most overtly oppressive regimes probably on the face of planet Earth. And nothing like it has ever really been seen since, really, except for the exception of maybe China under Mao. But there are particular and specific material reasons for this. It has nothing to do with the failure of Marxism or anything like that, or the nasty character of Lenin or Stalin or anything like that. What it essentially means is that just because you have a revolution, a socialist revolution, the working class comes to power, it doesn't mean that you have socialism. On October 26th, or whatever, November 8th, 1917, socialism didn't exist in Russia just because the Soviets had taken power. And in fact, over the 80 years of development of the Soviet Union, there was never any socialism. Socialism never existed in the Soviet Union. And it's important to understand that when the working class conquers power, when it organizes itself as the ruling class, it hasn't built socialism. It simply now has the tools, it has the state, to go about continuing the class struggle in such a way that it can actually develop and build socialism. It now has the ability, the freedom to go about that development. And of course, this development of socialism, like anything else in history, isn't going to develop in a straight line, in just a sort of gradual straight line where there's no problems. It's going to weave, it's going to wave, there's going to be setbacks, there's going to be leaps forward, and so on and so forth. It'll develop in a dialectical manner. And it's important to realize that when we're talking about a worker state, there's worker states and then there's worker states. Worker states don't just exist as a perfect form, like Plato spoke about 2,000 years ago, or it doesn't just exist as a perfectly democratic entity. Worker states exist and arise in concrete conditions, and they are determined by those conditions in which they arise. So what we're talking about is a worker state in Russia in 1917, not in the middle of nowhere, not in philosophy, not in heaven, not anything like that. Russia 1917. And basically what you can see is that in Russia, the economy had not been developed enough to develop socialism in Russia. The conditions just simply were not there. And if you look at Trotsky's theory of the permanent revolution, what we understand is that although the conditions were not ripe in Russia for socialism, they were ripe on a world scale. And this was the whole idea behind the Russian Revolution, that the Russian Revolution was the first shot in the world revolution, and that the only way that Russia, or the world proletariat, could actually move towards a new society was on the basis of a united movement worldwide. The appropriation of the means of production on a world level, which would then allow the development, the free development of man, of socialism. And what this literally comes down to in the Russian Revolution was the failure of the German Revolution. Russia had next to no industry, it was an extremely poor country, extremely backwards, productivity was extremely low, so on and so forth. And what the Russians really needed was the advanced techniques, the big factories, the educated working class from Germany, from France, from Britain, and the rest of Europe, in order to push the Russian Revolution forward. But this didn't happen, of course. The revolutions in Europe failed one after another in the 1920s and the 1930s, and the Russian Revolution ends up isolated, completely isolated. And not just isolated, but smashed. The civil war that Russia, that the Reds waged against the Whites, the war against the imperialist armies, completely drained Russia. Completely smashed Russia. In fact, in 1921, Russian production fell so low that there was mass starvation. There was no food, they had no coal, they had no oil. And you're basically asking a society, one of the poorest societies in the world, you're now basically asking it to build the most advanced society out of nothing. And if you remember what Trotsky said in his short little pamphlet on If America Should Go Communist, he even points out that even if there was a socialist revolution in the United States of America, the most advanced capitalist country in the world, you would still have bureaucratic problems. You would still have similar problems to what existed in the Soviet Union. Now, they wouldn't be quite as acute or quite as bad. They would be alleviated by the fact that America was the most developed country in the world, the richest country in the world. But still, you would not be able to build socialism in the United States alone. It would still have to be an international or a worldwide revolution. And so what basically happens in Russia is that a certain section of society, the bureaucrats, basically become self-aware. to become aware of their positions in society, to become aware of the privileges they have in society, and they're not interested in giving that up anymore. I mean, there's actually even certain parallels with the Venezuelan Revolution. The bureaucrats in the Bolshevik Party and the Communist Party in Russia, for them, the revolution had done all it could for them. They didn't want it to go anymore. They'd received their position, their money, their privileges, and so on. And they didn't want it to go any further. And they weren't interested in international revolution or in Soviet democracy or in party democracy, because that meant that they would lose their privileges. The development of genuine socialism in Russia would mean that they no longer had their positions. So they weren't interested in that anymore. And there's a certain similarity with Venezuela as well, where you have these the so-called Red Bolivarian bureaucracy or whatever, right? A whole bunch of bureaucrats who probably didn't have much connection with the revolution in the first place now have positions. They're important people in whatever ministry or whatever state-owned factory or whatever, and they want to keep that. And any further development of workers' control or planned economy or the communal councils, whatever Chavez is talking about, this is actually an attack on their privilege and their positions. So they don't want that to happen. And this is when they shift over to the counter-revolution and they want things to stop and to stand still and to stay as they are. Now, there's an important quote that Marx made in the 1870s when talking about the program of the German Social Democratic Party, when he said that law can never be higher than the economic conditions and the social conditions conditioned by them. So what that means is that the laws in society, or actually the actual structures in society, must correspond to the economic conditions which created them. So what that means is, as Trotsky also said of the revolution betrayed, he said, look, money, the family, and the state cannot be arbitrarily abolished. You can't legislate them out of existence, you can't decree them out of existence. What you need to do is actually build the social conditions in which these institutions can wither away. So obviously, if there's still class divisions in society, if one class has to rule over another, you still need a state. And you can't just stand up and say, oh, well, we don't need the state anymore. It's completely nonsense. And so what happens in Russia, obviously, is the class divisions were intense. And actually, the revolution didn't soften the class struggle or the division of classes in society. It actually strengthened it, and it actually made it much more acute. And what you have is the development of what we term proletarian Bonapartism. And Bonapartism is essentially a situation where the class divisions in society are so strong, so acute, that the state actually the state almost becomes an independent force. It raises itself above the rest of society and regulates the class struggle in such a way that society doesn't consume itself in a constant civil war. So essentially what we're talking about, if you read The State and Revolution by Lenin, or if you read some of the other works of Marx, you start talking about this idea of the first or the lower stage of communism and then the higher stage of communism. And so basically what you're talking about is, well, you can't even talk about the first stage of communism in Russia. You can't talk about socialism. But you can talk about the struggle towards getting there. And basically what this is, it's I don't want to get into too far into it. But basically what it means is that in any situation in where absolute general equality cannot be guaranteed, there will be a state, and that state will have to defend inequality. It will have to defend the wealth of a minority. And the Soviet state essentially did this. It defended the bureaucracy, and it defended their privileges and their interests. And as Marx also explained, when he's talking about these different stages of communism and socialism, he says that the development of the productive forces is the absolutely necessary practical premise of communism, because without it, want is generalized, and with want, the struggle for necessities begins again, and that means that all the old crap must revive. And Trotsky furthers this as well, where he explains in the Russian Revolution that this is a material thing. It's not up in the air or something. But he says, look, in Russia there's not enough food. We have bread queues. If you have bread queues, you have to have a policeman to keep order. And the policeman and the state controls the policeman, and the state determines who gets what. Otherwise, you just have madness, a struggle, an open struggle daily for bread. Well, the state regulates this process, and it determines who gets the bread and who doesn't get the bread. And out of this, you have this bureaucracy, which is now aware of the fact that it decides who gets bread, and it likes that, and it wants to maintain that that relationship. So basically, you have this development of proletarian Bonapartism, the enormous development of the Soviet state. And as I was saying before, the worker state doesn't exist. The worker state doesn't exist as some sort of platonic form, as some sort of pure entity. As slave-owning states can have different forms, as bourgeois states can have different forms, so can a worker state. I mean, why not? Lenin even said that a worker state could be expressed through the dictatorship of one man, which in the end is actually what happened under Stalin. You can envision a whole, depending on the circumstances or the context, you can envision a whole completely different range of types of a worker state. So it's a bit ridiculous to sort of say that, oh well, because Stalin came about and Russian Revolution didn't succeed, that the worker state either did never exist or that it cannot exist, that it's always bound to fail. It's a bit ridiculous. I mean, these things exist in concrete circumstances. So this bureaucracy becomes aware, it develops, it controls the state, it's in charge. It's important to understand that it is not a class. A class is defined by the relation of a group of people in production. And the bureaucracy in the Soviet Union had no role in production. They were not stockholders, they were not shareholders, they didn't own the factories, they were managers, they managed. So basically what they were was a parasitic caste which lifted itself above society and ruled society in its own interest. And that actually meant defending the planned economy. One of the greatest conquests of the Russian Revolution was the nationalization of the means of production, the planned economy. And for the first sort of 20, 30, 40 years of the Russian Revolution, after the revolution, the bureaucracy had to defend that planned economy. That was its source of privilege and income. That's what it was based upon. And it had to defend that, parasitically, of course. And increasingly over time, as the bureaucracy grew and grew and grew, it began to actually consume more and more of a proportion of the surplus value, of the extra wealth created in society. This, in turn, actually plugged up the planned economy. As Ted used to always say, it plugged up the pores of the planned economy. And actually, in the end, is what brought down the Soviet Union, which completely confirmed Trotsky's prediction on the Soviet Union, where he said in the 1930s that while basically one of two things are going to happen, more or less, you will either have a proletarian revolution, a political revolution where the proletariat kicks out the bureaucrats from the state and regenerates Soviet democracy, regenerates the workers' state, or the bureaucracy, in order to solidify or to legitimize its privileges, will actually make a move towards capitalism so that it can be the legitimate owner of the means of production and guarantee and pass on those privileges. Because in the past, the bureaucrat was just a bureaucrat. He may have had a bigger wage, he might have had more money than everybody else, but he couldn't pass down his job to his kids. He was a member of a political party, of a bureaucracy, and somebody else might take that position when he retires or if he gets fired or whatever. He can't pass down those privileges to his family, and he has an interest in doing this. So after a period, you start seeing that the bureaucrats are warming up to capitalism, and when the event finally comes down in the 1990s, the bureaucracy almost as a whole moves over to capitalism, and now you see in Russia that most of the big industrialists and factory owners and so on and so forth are former bureaucrats of the Communist Party. And in a way, you can see that this whole development of the state, it's a necessary development in man's development. In a lot of ways, it's almost like the negation of the negation, so to speak. We begin off as humans in a relatively equal society under primitive communism, but we require this very long phase of inequality, of extreme inequality at times, in order to develop the means of production, in order to develop the abundance, which would then be necessary to reestablish society on an equal basis, a communist basis, but on a much higher level than what it was 10,000 years ago. So we're almost coming around full circle. We have this long period in between where we have this massive development of the productive forces. And the only way you could actually develop the productive forces, develop the wealth necessary to establish communist society, was by actually going through the different phases of development, of slave society, of feudalism, of capitalism, of gross inequality, which was the motor force of the development of the productive forces. So obviously, we're looking back at history. We can see that the first several attempts to create a genuine workers' state have failed. I mean, the Paris Commune failed. The Russian Revolution failed. The Chinese Revolution is eating itself up, basically, and the old sort of Stalinist state is now becoming openly bourgeois, openly capitalist. But we have learned our lessons. As Marxists, as Trotskyists, we've gone back, we've studied the history, we've applied the ideas of Marxism to this history, and we've learned the lessons of why these things happened and where these failures came about. And it's extremely important, as I said at the beginning, when we're talking about the Venezuelan Revolution, where all these things become very clear. As Marx, of course, spoke about in revisions to the Communist, in relation to the Paris Commune, he says, look, what's clear from this is that the working class cannot take hold of the ready-made state machine and use it for its own purposes. What he means is that the proletariat in a revolution cannot simply lay hold of the bourgeois state and use it for themselves. And this is an important lesson for Chavez, which Chavez has or is in the process of learning. What is a bourgeois state? Well, obviously it's the tool, it's the apparatus that the bourgeoisie uses to impose its rule on everybody else. And obviously the working class cannot use that. It has to smash that state. That state is its opponent. That state is what is actually keeping the working class down. So the workers actually have to have their own state, their own apparatus, which they can use to smash the bourgeoisie and have their own state. And we saw in Russia, this is infinitely more democratic than even the most, democratic bourgeois state. Whereas the bourgeois state is based on a very small proportion of society, the rulers, the owners, the banks, the trusts, the big factories. The proletarian state is also based on the same thing, the factories and all these things, but it's based on the masses. You have Soviets, which are now localized into each neighborhood where people get together and they vote and they decide on their own fate. And through a process of federation or whatever you want to call it, you have a national state where the working class can rule as the ruling class and can go ahead and build socialism. And Chavez has realized this. I mean, for the first basically 7 or 8 years of the revolution, he basically admitted that he thought that he could use the existing Venezuelan state, the bourgeois state, as a means of going ahead with the revolution. But now he's hit his head against the wall countless times. Every step he takes forward, the bureaucrats sabotage it. They hold it back. Every 2 steps he takes forward, they go 2 steps back. And it's a constant struggle for Chavez within his own state to get his ideas and his measures implemented, to get the actual goals of the revolution implemented. And so now Chavez is actually talking openly about smashing the bourgeois state, about replacing it with the communal councils. He said he wants to see an explosion of communal councils. And over the past period, you've seen an attempt on the part of the Bolivarian movement to establish these councils in the factories, in the countryside, the peasant estates, in the neighborhoods, and so on and so forth. And it's these mass organizations, these democratic organizations, which will become the basis of a workers' state in Venezuela. And obviously, as we spoke about in relation to the Russian Revolution, if Venezuela has a socialist revolution, if the working class establishes itself as the ruling class, this is no guarantee that you'll have socialism in Venezuela whatsoever. But it doesn't mean that there is a chance. There's a good opportunity for the working class to spread the revolution to the rest of Latin America, in Brazil, Bolivia, Cuba, so on and so forth, to actually go about establishing that, socialism for the first time on planet Earth. Right, I think I'll leave it there for now.